Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. This is Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 23rd of July, these are our main stories. The UK government says Iran's seizure of a British flag ship is an act of state piracy. Huge crowds have rallied in the US territory of Puerto Rico, demanding the immediate resignation of the governor. And police in the Nigerian capital Abuja are accused of killing protesters during clashes there. Also in this podcast... the anti-war song that was banned in Iran, but its creator found a way around it. The UK government has reacted to Iran's seizure of a British flag ship in the Strait of Hormuz, announcing plans to set up a new protection mission. The British Foreign Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, called the seizure an act of state piracy. The Stena Impero and its 23-man crew are now in a heavily guarded Iranian port. Mr. Hunt said with a heavy heart he was announcing an increased international presence in the Gulf to protect freedom of navigation.
Firstly, the Department of Transport has raised the security level for British flag shipping to level 3, advising against all passage in Iranian waters and, for the moment, in the entire Strait of Hormuz. Secondly, because freedom of navigation is a vital interest of every nation, we will now seek to put together a European-led maritime protection mission to support safe passage of both crew and cargo in this vital region. We've had constructive discussions with a number of countries in the last 48 hours, and we will discuss later this week the best way to complement this with recent US proposals in this area. The new force will be focused on free navigation, bearing in mind that one-fifth of the world's oil, a quarter of its liquefied natural gas, and trade worth $500 billion passes through the Strait of Hormuz every year. It will not be part of the US maximum pressure policy on Iran because we remain committed to preserving the Iran nuclear agreement.
Iranian state media says the tanker was captured after it collided with a fishing boat and then failed to respond to calls. Earlier in the day, the US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was asked by Fox News about any possible US involvement in the tanker crisis.
The responsibility in the first instance falls to the United Kingdom to take care of their ships. But you know this story. This isn't because of American sanctions. This is because the theocracy, the leadership in Iran, their revolutionary zeal to conduct terror around the world for now 4 decades continues. This is a bad regime. It's not honoring the people of Iran. They've now conducted what amounts to national piracy, right? A nation state taking over a ship that's traveling in international waters. The United States has a responsibility to do our part, but the world's got a big role in this, too, to keep these sea lanes open.
President Trump told reporters the U.S. will wait and see what happens. Our political correspondent out of Washington, Gary O'Donoghue, told me more about how the U.S. differs in its approach to Iran.
I think you could hear that, couldn't you, in the tone of Mike Pompeo's words there, up to the UK to look after its own boats in that sense. And that's because for some time the US has been calling on its allies to send more hardware to the region to protect shipping. It's wanted to have a sort of combined, coordinated response to the security problem in the Gulf and then in the Strait as well. And the Europeans have been pretty reluctant to do it. The British have had a frigate there, just that one that was too far away to prevent the boarding of the Stena Impero. And they've got a smaller boat there as well. They're sending some more hardware down there now. But it's also an indication of the wider tension, Andrew, the wider tension over the nuclear agreement and the fact that the Americans pulled out of it while the Europeans still thought it was working well.
And Britain wants to cling to its European allies and not support US policy to trash the Iran nuclear deal. It still wants to stick to that line by the sound of it.
It does at the moment, but I think it's worth bearing in mind that we're in a moment of huge transition in London as well, aren't we? We're due to get a new prime minister by sometime on Wednesday. That whole stance could change at that point in time. Having said that, Boris Johnson, who's likely to be the next Prime Minister after that Conservative Party leadership election concludes tomorrow, he has said during the hustings for the top job that he wouldn't support any military action against Iran. And of course, as we know, President Trump came within 10 minutes of striking Iran recently after that US drone was shot down, etc. So there is still, I think, probably some substantial amounts of daylight. But you know, a new administration in London can change the weather a little bit on those talks. And we may see Boris Johnson wanting to get a bit closer to America. And at the moment, the issue of the moment is Iran. And so he will, you know, that will be one of the things on the first phone call, on the first meeting that will have to be discussed.
Gary O'Donoghue with me from Washington. Now, staying in Iran, the authorities there have banned the singer Mehdi Yarahi from performing his popular anti-war song, Paresang, because he refused to change the anti-establishment lyrics, which speak out against war. A phone video from a recent concert has been trending online where the background music for the song was played. Mr. Yarahi left the stage and then the audience sang it without him. Sarush Pakzad is from the BBC Persian social media team and spoke to Chloe Tilley about that video.
The singer's name is Mehdi Yarahi. He had few controversial music videos before and musics before. About this song, he had released this song about 6 months ago in January, and by the time of the releasing the music video, both the lyrics and the music has been criticized by the Iranian state media because he's in the video. It shows that war doesn't have anything good for people, and it reflects some images and videos and contents about the Iran-Iraq war of years ago. He had to get permission to perform every single song and every single thing for his concerts. So apparently the government, they didn't give him the permission to perform it himself. So what they've done at the end of the concert, they just left all the musicians and himself. They left the stage and they broadcasted the lyrics on a projector. And so the audience, they knew the song and they started like singing the song. So he didn't do anything wrong because he didn't sing it himself. And it was the audience who loved to do that.
So have there been any consequences for him or indeed the people in the audience?
I haven't seen anything yet. I know that he has another concert soon, within the next month. So we have to see if they will put him under any different circumstances or not.
I guess it's quite a difficult line for this singer to tread, isn't it? To be able to put forward the lyrics and the message he wants to, but equally making sure that he doesn't upset the government.
Yes, this is not his first time. Before this song, he had another song about the Iranian workers within the war zone region, which is the south of Iran, which he comes from. The people that are struggling about the work, about the different things. And he was wearing the clothes of some protesters, workers, who many of them are still in jail, and he performed a song with those outfits. So that also became like controversial, and they banned him from work for like 6 months.
Sarush Pakzad from BBC Persian. In Puerto Rico, tens of thousands of protesters are rallying in the capital, San Juan, demanding the resignation of the island's governor, Ricardo Rosello. They blocked the main highway leading into the city. Our America's editor, Leonardo Rocha, reports.
Mr. Rosello has been involved in a series of scandals since a devastating hurricane hit Puerto Rico 2 years ago. His government has been accused of siphoning off aid money and failing to rebuild the U.S. territory. But these protests have been triggered by the leak of hundreds of pages of private messages. In many, Mr. Rosello makes offensive remarks about rival politicians, women in general, gay people, and even the victims of Hurricane Maria. On Sunday, he apologized and said he would leave office next year at the end of his term. But protesters say he must stand down immediately.
Leonardo Rocha reporting. Motor neuron disease stops messages from the brain and the spinal cord from getting to muscles. In most cases, the physicist Stephen Hawking being a notable exception, it often leads to death within a few years. Now scientists in Israel have found that bacteria in the gut can play a role in the development of the disease. So how does that all work? A question I put to our science correspondent, James Gallagher.
This study basically has the quite surprising finding that gut microbes, bacteria that live inside our bodies, have a role not in starting the disease, but in the pace of its progression. They're influencing the duration of this disease, at least in experiments on mice and some early work on people too.
What strikes me as remarkable about this is that there is such a link between what's going on in our gut and what's going on in our brain.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Motor neuron disease is quite clearly a disease of the nerves. And, you know, that's got very little to do with our gut, you would think, most of the time. However, there is a massive field of research now that is showing that our bodies are more than just our human cells. There are human cells plus all of our microbial inhabitants. They far outnumber the human cells in our body, and they have really important implications for health. You know, Parkinson's disease, autism, there's huge amounts of research into both of those connecting our microbes and those conditions. And this is now adding to that field of research. And the way it seems to be working, at least in this case, is that the microbes that are living inside the gut are releasing chemicals. They enter the bloodstream and then they reach the brain. So it's not the microbes themselves getting to the brain. It's the chemicals that they're releasing into the body. And they're changing the activity of nerve cells, helping them survive a little bit longer and therefore slowing the pace of this disease.
And motor neuron disease is a condition with no treatment, let alone cure. The idea of isolating this link to bacteria in the gut will give people hope that you could remove those bacteria and that would help, would it?
The real challenge now is proving that this definitely works in people. So the studies on mice have been incredibly extensive and detailed. There's been some limited look at humans. They've shown that there are some chemicals that are lower in the brains of patients with this disease and that there are also differences in their gut microbes. However, they haven't proven it to the same extent as they have in mice. So that's going to be the real challenge. Can you show the same thing is happening in the human trials? And if you can, then yes, maybe this gives you a window into finding treatments in the future, because maybe you could add bacteria in. Maybe you could change diet to encourage the right species of bacteria to grow. Or maybe you could just give people the chemical the bacteria are producing. These are all new avenues for research. But it's quite important to state that this is all going to happen a long time in the future. And the researchers are not even thinking about this being a therapy that might either cure or prevent people getting motor neuron disease. It's about buying time. And this is a disease that tends to kill people with 3 to 5 years of first diagnosis. So, you know, buying time will be an incredibly important thing even then.
Our science correspondent, James Gallagher. Still to come in this podcast.
3, 2, 1, 0.
One giant leap for India as they aim to join the global elite on the moon. Let's turn to Nigeria next. Police in the capital Abuja are accused of opening fire on protesters from the Shia Muslim group known as the Islamic Movement of Nigeria. A spokesman for the organisation said 11 demonstrators had been killed and more than 30 injured. Nigeria's police force accused the protesters of being violent. There are reports that one officer was killed. Chloe Tilley spoke to our correspondent Ishak Khalid there and asked him to explain what we know about the situation.
So far, what we know is that members of the Shia group, Islamic Movement of Nigeria, came out again today in the Nigerian capital, Abuja, to protest, demanding the release of their leader, Sheikh Ibrahim El-Zakzaki. And they met with the police force, and then the police allegedly fired live bullets, killing a number of Shia protesters. And the scene was very violent. There was gunfire, and some vehicles have also been burnt down. And there were, of course, deaths and injuries. But so far, we don't know how many people have been killed. But I've spoken with one of the protesters who told me that he saw 6 dead bodies, but he was not sure how many in total were killed. Some were shot in the head, some in the stomach, and then other parts of the body. And there was also a journalist with a local TV station, China's TV, who was shot and injured in the stomach. The television station has confirmed that they say he was hit by a stray bullet. So the situation at the moment is quite is returning to normal after long period of standoff between the police and the Shia protesters. But the police are saying that they took the action against the protesters because the protest was turning violent.
Just fill us in on the background to this. For example, who the Islamic Movement of Nigeria are.
Well, the Islamic Movement of Nigeria is a Shia Muslim group in Nigeria. It's a pro-Iranian group. They have a sizable number of followers in Nigeria, particularly in the north of the country. And their leader, Ibrahim El-Zakzaki, has been in detention since 2015 when his followers were attacked by the Nigerian military following a standoff. And there was a crackdown by the military. About 300 of his followers were killed, according to Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, during that crackdown. And he was arrested. He is facing charges related to uprising and public disturbances. And what the members, his followers, are saying is that there have been court orders for his release, but the Nigerian authorities have ignored those court orders, and the trial continues. And they are saying that what they have, the information they have, is that he is sick, and they want him to be released for medical, treatment.
Ishak Khalid reporting. Now to the Philippines, where President Rodrigo Duterte has delivered his annual State of the Nation address. In it, he staunchly defended his controversial war on drugs, a policy that claims more than 20,000 lives, with human rights groups saying many of the victims are innocent. The president insisted illegal drugs cause devastation and the program must continue.
I am aware that we still have a long way to go in our fight for crimes related to illegal drugs. The drugs will not be crossed unless we continue to eliminate corruption that allows the social monster to survive. I respectfully request Congress to reinstate the death penalty for heinous crimes related to drugs as well as plunder.
Mr. Duterte, who's halfway through his six-year term, also called for the reinstatement of the death penalty to tackle drugs crimes as well as corruption, which he said was costing the government millions of dollars. But these Filipino activists said Mr. Duterte was failing the state.
The state of the nation on the third year of Rodrigo Duterte. It is not something that we can be proud of. It is not something that we should celebrate. It is something that we should be seriously concerned about.
The real state of the nation is extreme poverty. The real state of the nation is surrender to China. The real state of the nation is tyranny and human rights violations.
Your ratings are very high and your choir is still very strong. But do know that there are critics like us here outside who will continue to fight until the day that we can be free from you.
I think we can expect more of the same the next 3 years, more human rights violations, more killings in the name of the war on drugs, more invasion of our territory by another country. It's going to be the same story.
Some Filipino activists there speaking out against President Duterte. The most valuable resource in the modern workplace isn't new technology or even robots. In fact, it's older people. That's according to Elizabeth Ezell, the founder and CEO of the Global Institute for Experienced Entrepreneurship, who told my colleague David Whitty why we need to change the way we see age in the workplace.
We need to think about experience as a currency. And if we can tap into catalyzing experience, seniors' work-life experience with younger people's technology experience across generations, we will have such a head start on boosting economies locally and globally. Just in terms of the older workforce, as much as I hate to segregate the older workforce, but in the UK, for example, research has demonstrated that if the employment rate of the 50 to 64-year-olds matched that of the 35 to 49-year-old age group, the UK economy could be boosted by £88 billion annually. And in Australia, they have research has demonstrated that an increase of just 7% of 50-plus-year-olds in the workplace could increase Australia's GDP by $25 billion by 2022.
Now, you're speaking to the whole world with this interview. Older people on every continent in the world are listening to you. What's your advice to someone in Africa or someone in Asia or someone in Australasia who's older and wants to start a business but just doesn't know how to get their idea off the ground?
Everybody always says, well, the most critical thing in starting a new business is access to capital. And I say over and over again, around the world, it is not access to capital. It's having the confidence to think that you can do it and then reaching out and creating a network of people that can help you do it. Because so many people have lived their lives entrepreneurially, but have never identified as an entrepreneur. They think, well, I'm not an entrepreneur, be it a woman in Africa or a woman in Japan who has left the workforce. And I say, what have you done in terms of managing your family, managing resources, your whole financial aspect for raising this family? All of those skills are an entrepreneurial mindset. You're not Steve Jobs. You're not Bill Gates. But you are an entrepreneur because you have created a life many times from nothing. And so you have to have the confidence that you can step forward.
Elizabeth Ezell of the Global Institute for Experienced Entrepreneurship. India's space agency has launched an unmanned spacecraft, the far side of the moon, just a week after aborting this high-profile mission due to what were described as technical snags. The plan to put out a landing craft on the surface of the moon, making India one of the small group of countries to do so. Our South Asia correspondent Rajini Vaidyanathan reports from Delhi.
3, 2, 1, 0.
Into the skies and off to the moon. From a small island by the Bay of Bengal, India's space dreams soared to new heights. 49 metres tall, with an Indian flag painted on the side, the unmanned lunar mission Chandrayaan 2, which means moon vehicle, was launched successfully.
L110 performance normal.
It was a tense moment for scientists in the control room at India Space Research Organisation. The original takeoff a week ago had to be aborted due to technical problems. Across the country, people stopped to watch.
3, 2, 1, 0.
At this school in West Delhi, students gathered in the auditorium to witness history.
It is a very wonderful day for every Indian because India has taken this initiative. I'm really proud to be an Indian.
I feel like India should do more projects like this. It is a huge opportunity for India to take place amongst the great countries that are leading in astronomy, like US, Russia, China.
Chandrayaan 2 is a 3-in-1 mission of ISRO.
India's mission's expected to touch down in September. When it does, this nation will join an elite club of space powers, the US, Russia and China, who've also soft-landed spacecraft on the moon.
The mightiest rocket ever built by India.
This government video explains Chandrayaan's goal.
Stage, GSLV Mark III will inject us into a highly elliptical orbit around the...
India's aiming to become the first country to land on the unexplored lunar South Pole. Last year, the country's Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, pledged to send an Indian into orbit by the year 2022. We will send a son or daughter of India to space, he told the crowd at an Independence Day event in August.
It is one of the biggest trips we have ever taken in the space industry for India.
At just 19 years old, Rifat Sharukh has already earned his place in India's space history. The brains behind the world's smallest ever satellite, which was launched 2 years ago, he believes this latest mission is another huge leap for India's space ambitions.
From the technical side, it's one of the most complicated missions. If we can soft land on the moon, then we can also soft land on the Mars. Once we achieve that capability, we can also soft land humans on the moon. So we are going one step near to putting our Indians on the moon.
But not everyone thinks it's a good idea. There's long been a debate about whether this country should be investing in space when so many millions are living in poverty.
This mission will help us better understand the origin and evolution of the moon.
There are many. But those behind the program say it was a relatively low-cost mission. At just $145 million, it comes in less than half the budget of the latest Avengers film. Many here say space exploration is important to India's future and is the country's very own blockbuster moment.
Prachini Vaidyanathan, our correspondent in Delhi. And that's all from us for now. There will be an updated Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition of the podcast or the stories we included, do drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. My name is Andrew Peach. Thank you for listening. And until next time, goodbye.